broadcasting around the world from the desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona, this is The Dividing Line. The Apostle Peter commanded Christians to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us, yet to give that answer with gentleness and reverence. Our host is Dr. James White, Director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and an elder at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. This is a live program, and we invite your participation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. White, call now at 602-973-4602 or toll free across the United States. It's 1-877-753-3341. And now with today's topic, here is James White.
And good afternoon. Welcome to The Dividing Line. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity of moving the program to this hour, because that allowed me to press forward on some studying that I needed to do this morning on a rather lengthy jaunt into the Sonoran Desert. What I'm doing, just to mention this, no one's asked me about it yet. I'm trying to be proactive here. But you may have noticed, I've noticed it even as I've been looking at stuff online. Sometime last week, a video popped up, in that right-hand ad column, wherever you're on these websites that, Google tracks all your stuff. And I just realized one of our cameras looks really goofy. I guess it's just still goofy. We got to fix that or it's going to get burned up. Anyways, I saw this video and I'd seen this book. In fact, I'd pre-ordered this book. Someone was kind enough to get me the Kindle version just a few days ago. But Candida Moss is a professor at Notre Dame and has put out a book, and I watched the video. I should have queued that video up. Sorry about that. If I could find it again. I mean, it was in an ad column. I don't even remember which website it was on. But anyway, basically, she's saying that not only was there no persecution of Christians in antiquity, but the amazing thing was she basically said, and there isn't today either, which I found pretty amazing. And immediately recognized that this must be addressed. But I thought, what most folks are going to do is they're going to go get the book and maybe scan through it. Obviously, I'll listen to all of it. But I took the time to look at her previous publications and noted that she had put out a book just a few years ago on the martyrs as Christs. And so I thought, well, if I'm going to do this right, the best way to do it would be to take the time to read her previous book, which doesn't look like it's meant for a non-scholarly audience, and try to sort of trace the line of development to what looks like this new book looks like it's more of a popular level thing. And given that the publisher, I believe, is the same publisher that's done most of Bart Ehrman's books, that might be a good thing to do, because a lot of people have pointed out the great differences between Ehrman's popular level books and his much fewer scholarly books. And so that's what I was doing. I finished that up. I started listening to it on the way down to Tucson this past weekend. Had a great time down at Faith Community Church in Tucson this past weekend. And on the drive back, which was also rather dangerous, because I was having to drive on Sunday afternoon. And as a Baptist, I am genetically predisposed to sleep on Sunday afternoon. And so to combine lunch with driving and listening to the Candida Moss book, the scholarly one, that was dangerous. That was dangerous. I had to stop somewhere, I forget where, near Toltec Road. And I went through the drive-thru at McDonald's. And have y'all noticed that if you try to order a chocolate shake at McDonald's, they not only is it like 74 times more expensive than it was when I was a kid, but now you get it in some frou-frou, see-through plastic Starbucks cup with a dome top and whipped cream and a cherry. Do you know that? If you try to order, you're busy. I can tell that. Okay. Well, see, you heard McDonald's, didn't you? That's why you all of a sudden, ah, McDonald's, he says something about McDonald's. You would not recognize McDonald's chocolate shakes anymore. And you are, you have a degree from Hamburger U, don't you?
I used to, yes.
Did you give it back?
That was a long, long time ago in a land far, far away.
Did they expire?
No.
Oh, okay. So then you still have a degree from Hamburger U.
Technically, I guess I do, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Well, have you seen chocolate shakes recently from McDonald's?
I have not. No.
They are in the frou-frou, see-through plastic cups from Starbucks, the little dome top with whipped cream and a cherry.
Yeah.
And they cost $3 and something.
Sacrilege.
Oh, it's ridiculous.
Yes.
But it was very good.
Oh, you had one?
I had to.
Oh.
I was explaining to folks that I was driving back from Tucson, and I was dying. I was.
I'm sure the resulting sugar rush.
Oh, it was good. That was very helpful. Yeah, it got me home in one piece. So
pedal to the metal, let's go.
That's what I had to do. People are saying I'm on a tangent, but really I'm not. In fact, I've forgotten what I was talking about. Anyways, oh, okay. So back to what we're doing here. So I finished off the preceding book. Now I got to record the new book, and it'll be interesting to see. There was the only thing in the book that I read. And I need to get the exact name, I suppose, while I'm at it here. But the only thing that I caught in that was the assertion that there was a citation of certain individuals who basically said, well, there's a paucity of evidence for the earlier persecution. But there was really nothing in this book that questioned at all the historical reality of the persecution of Christians. The book that I read was The Other Christ, Imitating Jesus and Ancient Christian Ideologies of Martyrdom, from February 15th of last year, 2012. So this is pretty. The myth of persecution, how early Christians invented a story of martyrdom, is only 1 year and 1 month later. And if you've seen the videos, she looks like she's 19. She really does. It's amazing. But that will be very, very interesting to look at. No, I did not look at Ancient Christian Martyrdom, Diverse Practices, Theologies, and Traditions from the Anchor Yale Bible Reference Library, because that says May 21st, 2012, and the one I read is February 15th, 2012. So something tells me that they're really closely related, but I could be wrong, I suppose. Maybe I'll need to get that one too. I don't know. It was not exciting. The book I read was definitely meant for scholarly consumption. And, I don't think the myth of persecution is. So anyways, I'm getting ready to tackle that one because I just have a feeling that we are going to be hearing a lot about that. And it takes a lot of time to tackle it correctly. And that's what we're trying to do. I don't always have the time to do that, but I also was working through the George Weigel book, which I mentioned last week, Evangelical Catholicism. And if that phrase grates on you, it should grate on you just as badly as Reformed Catholicism used to grate upon us. And I'm glad folks have pretty much given up on that phrase. But be that as it may, I got a good way through it on the ride today because it was very windy. I was going uphill against the wind on a recumbent. The combination of the three was pretty ugly. I saw a tumbleweed rolling past me, and it was going faster than I was. But anyway, and basically, you know, I heard him say lots of nice things. You know, we need to be more biblical and, you know, all the rest of this stuff. But if you listen really carefully, there really wasn't anything there that would give me any reason to think that there was any basis for believing that the evangel has anything to do with this. In fact, when he talked about excellent examples of bishops in the history of the Roman Catholic Church, I noticed a number of times that Francis de Sales was referenced, and Alfonso Liguori was specifically referenced. And if you're familiar with those names at all, then you know that, you know, this is not someone who's taking seriously the Reformed criticism of Rome's gospel or anything even close to that. And so anyway, I bet you there's a webcam someplace. Maybe somebody in channel can find me a link to the, there's got to be a webcam somewhere that someone has focused upon that chimney you know. Yeah. Oh, wow. Her PhD is from Yale in New Testament from 2008. Well, Yale. Yeah, that'll tell you everything from Yale. Okay. That tells you something right there. Yale, and Yale. Okay. Thank you very much, Turretin fan. All right. Anyways, so we're doing that. And of course, we're keeping an eye on what's going on with the conclave. It is interesting to listen to. Do you have something?
I saw this tweet this morning from Rick Warren.
Did you hear about that? Someone sent me a screenshot of that.
I have it right here. Join me today in fasting and prayer for the 115 cardinals seeking God's will in a new leader.
There you go. That's I don't even know what to say about that. I mean, if they actually heard God's will, they would disband. Okay, I mean, God's will in oh, there it is. See, Micah got it. I knew it was out there someplace.
They would take off their fancy vestments and put on sackcloth and ashes.
Yeah, they'd take off their fancy red caps and stuff like that. Yeah, I don't watch live below via NBC News. Oh, okay, that's interesting. It's not.
Bet you Fox News has got a close up.
It's not really showing anything right now, at least not that I can see. But anyway, yeah, this really is showing, I think, how completely outside mainstream we now are. And I'm including myself in that. Just completely how far out of mainstream that we are. Because, look, the vast majority of people are going, wow, isn't this great? Isn't this wonderful? Isn't this exciting? And I even listened to Hugh Hewitt, and Hugh Hewitt's all excited, and everybody's like, ooh, this is so cool. And if you go, excuse me, but, you know, there's really no biblical basis for this. And in fact, you know, the papacy down through history has stood firmly opposed to the gospel of Christ, and they've got blood on their hands, and they're still preaching a false gospel. Oh, come on. Can't you just let bygones be bygones? And that's how people really think. They just don't even give a second thought anymore, because it's, well, you know, but they believe in the resurrection, and they believe in the existence of God, and they say nice things about the Bible. So, look, we all need to stick together, you know? We need to stop worrying about all this theology stuff, and we just all need to stick together. And that's how people think. And the vast majority of non-Roman Catholics in the United States and in most Western countries are simply by tradition and not by conviction. And if you, by conviction, do not believe that the papacy is established by God or blessed by God or anything else, you're in a small minority anymore. You really, really are. And welcome. It's good to have you with us. But it's not that it's not a big news story. It is. I personally do find the silly-looking shoes and silly-looking hats and all the rest of that stuff very, very silly. Almost in a British Monty Python way of silliness. And I haven't heard almost anybody pointing out that this is not how the Bishop of Rome was chosen for the first many, many hundreds of years. The Bishop of Rome was chosen by the people of Rome itself. And this whole thing is a much later development, and you know, I'll let them explain all that stuff. But it's not to say it's not a big news story. And the funny thing is, I just sit around going, well, you know, right now, I would imagine that the consistent Roman Catholic apologist is not wanting to debate right now, because they can't really know what the truth is. Because, you know, they always tell us, we can always go to the Pope. Well, right now you don't got one. So I guess you shouldn't be debating right now, but not that you could ever get to him anyways. It's sort of a silly thing, but that's just how it is. But, you know, if they do choose a reformist pope, then what if he sets the church on a track that it continues down that eventually alters the understanding of certain beliefs, certain practices or beliefs of the Roman Catholic Church? You know, I'll never, ever forget writing to Robertson Jenness years ago and presenting to him contradictory statements from popes on doctrinal issues. And his response was to say, who are you to interpret what the church meant back then? Only the church today can interpret what it meant back then. Now, I'm not sure he'd still hold that position, because there's a lot of places where modern folks would say he's jumped off the boat, tracks, jumped the shark, whatever terminology you want to use. But the fact is, when you believe in sola ecclesia, then if a reformist pope today starts a trend that results in a different interpretation of the Marian dogmas, 100 years from now, how are you supposed to hold them accountable for that change? You can't. Because 100 years from now, if you look at it and go, yeah, but that's not what you believed back in 2013, they go, but who are you to say what we believed back in 2013? Only the church knows what it believed in 2013, and the church is your ultimate authority. Right? I guess that's how it works when you have that kind of ultimate authority. So we will obviously comment. I think they said that the vast majority of popes of the past, 100 years, have been elected within 3 days. So good probability that, or at least good possibility, that by the, Mutato says they are unpoped, popeless, dispopable. Dispopable, there's a good word, dispopable. There's a good possibility that by Thursday we'll be commenting on whatever the news is saying, because I'll be perfectly honest with you. I don't sit around reading biographies of the leading candidates for the papacy and the papal curia or anything else. It's not my issue, interest whatsoever. I suppose I should bring this up and look at it, because you just mentioned in channel that we've got something there. And yeah, look at that. Okay, well, before I go back to Zakir Hussain or anybody else, things like that, I guess I will take a phone call and talk with Vance. Hi, Vance.
Hello.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
I certainly can.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Oh, is this Dr. White?
Yes, it is.
Oh, gee, I'm sorry. I'm brain freeze right there. My question is on Aramaic originals. I have a neighbor across the street that's really gotten into this, and he told me, he's gave me a little paperwork to look at, that the New Testament was originally written in Aramaic, and then they had scribes translated into Greek.
Uh-huh.
And I never heard that before, so I figured I'd check with a reliable source.
All right,
find out if there's any.
There's good reason. Good reason why you didn't hear that before. There are a few folks. There's one book in the New Testament that you'll find serious scholars saying could possibly have originally been written in Aramaic, and that's the Gospel of Matthew. Even though they will then immediately say, but the Gospel of Matthew that we have today was not originally written in Aramaic. It was clearly originally written in Greek, and so they're basically saying that there was another Matthew, that primarily based upon some statements from some patristic sources on that subject. But there really isn't any possibility at all that Paul wrote the church at Colossae in Aramaic, because they didn't read Aramaic in Colossae. And so to write them to them in Aramaic would be like right now if I started speaking German to you. I mean, you may be excellent in the German language, but then again, you might not. And it wouldn't make much sense if I just started using a language that you've never learned to speak to you. Well, in the same way, it would be pretty silly for the apostles to write in languages that people did not understand. The Greek language, Koine Greek, was the universal tongue of the day. The Roman soldier who would start yelling at you would probably be doing so in Koine Greek, and it would always be very, very good if you had some idea what in the world he was yelling at you about, especially when he drew his sword. And so the utilization of that language would make perfect sense. And if you just analyze the Gospels themselves, especially, I mean, Luke, Acts, not even a slight possibility. But if you analyze them, you will see that their original form was Koine Greek. The Gospels do show evidence of certainly a knowledge of Aramaic, which is why they will include Aramaic terms like talithakumi, talithakumi, things like that, and will then provide a translation thereof. But if these were merely translations of Aramaic originals, they would look and sound very, very different than they do. And so there is no end of silly stuff to be found on the internet. There's, you know, the Hebrew roots movement and all the rest of this stuff. There's people running around wearing yarmulkes and stuff like that, saying that the only way you can understand the New Testament is to, you know, follow my particular take on Hebrew originals and all the rest of this stuff. So there's no end of silliness on the internet. It's just like the printing press. It can be used for good or bad. But the reality is that the original language of the New Testament is Koine Greek, and that's what it was written in. That's what gives the evidence is all clear on that particular issue.
Yeah, well, that's what I kind of thought, and I almost got the impression that Getty said, well, some scripture verses translate to give you more fuller meaning with the Aramaic.
Yeah. And isn't it funny, they come up with these wild, crazy interpretations of them that you've never, ever heard before, and it's like, oh, so that's why you want to come up with that. Now, can you show me these Aramaic originals? Well, no, but we're hypothesizing that this would have been what the original would have been. And the fact is, if they were originally written in Aramaic, they're gone. So we don't know what they would have said. And so any presupposition, any assumption, I'm sorry, as to what the original would have been is just that. It's just an assumption. It's sort of like when Roman Catholics say, well, when Jesus was talking to Peter, he would have said kephas, and that's what actually, there's a lot of people that say he would have used limna. You don't know because you don't have an original, and there's multiple ways in which you can translate things. And so, yeah, there's a lot of folks, they're looking to, you know, gather some disciples around themselves, and so they come up with some. You gotta have something unique. I mean, I could never start my own cult or ism or something like that because I'm not saying anything unique. I'm saying what people have said before, and you don't start your own cult or ism if you do stuff like that.
Right. I almost kind of got the impression it was some like Gnosticism that, ooh, we have secret knowledge, and if you study the Aramaic, then you'll have their secret knowledge just like us.
Well, see, you got to be careful with the Gnosticism accusation because it's not just secret knowledge, but it's secret knowledge that allows you to free your spirit from the physical realm and be rejoined to the One. So that,
right.
Not everything that has secret knowledge is necessarily Gnostic, but yeah, that's sort of what it is. To be honest with you, it's probably much more, I have secret knowledge, and send me $29.95, and I'll tell you about it.
All right.
That's how it works.
Okay.
Okay.
Do you have one more time for one
sure.
more quick question, but it's off a little different subject?
Sure. Murray up in Canada looks like a very patient fellow, so yes, we can do that.
Okay. It's just a quick one, because I hadn't heard you speak about this on the dividing line. I saw on a Christian news site that Phoenix passed a transgenders are allowed into bathrooms now, any bathroom they want.
You know, it's funny. I only found out about that myself, though I live here, a few weeks after it happened while I was down in Tucson. And I forget why I ran into it. But yes, that is true. The Phoenix City Council is, well, most city councils anymore are made up of loony leftists. And obviously, ours is made up of loony leftists, too. And simple common sense, simple morals, and simple ethics have definitely gone out the window all over the United States. And if you dare say that, you, of course, are a hater. But, yeah, that is the case.
Okay.
Good, be a good reason not to use public restrooms in Phoenix. And,
Yeah, it's also unfortunately true in the whole state of Colorado they passed.
Oh, yeah.
The
simple common sense, the only explanation as to how simple common sense can be being abandoned on this broad a level in Western society is the judgment of God. I mean, it's the only explanation I can come up with. The opening up little children, little girls, to that kind of danger, so that you can't even confidently take your little girl to a restroom in Phoenix or in Western culture places. The only explanation for this kind of utter stupidity is the judgment of God. That's all I can see.
Yep. Okay. I appreciate your help there with that Aramaic.
All righty, sir.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Bye.
877-753-3341 is the phone number, and I doubt that's the number that Murray called, but he called the other. The other number, if you're outside the United States, is the one that Rich tells you about at the beginning of the program, which is 602-973-4602. And that's how you get a hold of us. Let's talk to Murray. Hi, Murray.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Hi. Yeah, it's good to talk with you, Dr. White.
Yes, sir.
My question's about Islamic apologetics. Like, it's a big topic of mine. And the fact that you always, you know, in each debate you come with, you always seem to say that they're inconsistent.
Yep.
And they seem to not use, I've noticed the Quran, like I've gone through the Quran a couple times, a couple different translations, and I've seemed to notice that there's arguments built into the Quran.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not that good. That's why
that's
most
true.
Muslims
I would agree.
Don't use them.
They use some, but yeah, I have noticed that the most of the Western Islamic apologists tend to avoid the repetitive argumentation of the Quran, other than the produce a surah like it argument. They do tend to fall into that, though I think many of them recognize that's just one incredibly fallacious argument that carries no weight at all. But anyway.
And, yes, like I just brought up these arguments in the Quran. The Quran is technically, when you think about it, the first Islamic document to attack Christianity, like not necessarily a tafsir that came later or
right.
a polemic that came later, but it's the Quran.
Mm-hmm.
It does a very poor job about it, as you just said. But at the same time, the first, as far as I know, the first Christian or... I don't know if you'd, well, the first name under Christianity to attack Islam is John of Damascus.
There are some others that might be earlier than John. I mean, John's obviously the biggest name. You've got Al-Kindi, and dating some of these is a little bit challenging. You've got Timothy, the Nestorian bishop. You've got a fair amount of very interesting dialogues that come from around within 100 years of each other. Obviously from different contexts and of different quality.
And well, John's the first big one that most people know about, at least most Christians who are engaged in this kind of apologetic know about. And John Damascene, I mean, for his numerous faults, he is respected in the Orthodox Church, and
right.
he's called the Doctor of the Assumption in the Catholic Church. So I kind of use this to build him up. And then I say, look at his understanding of Islam compared with the Quran's understanding
of Christianity.
Of Christianity. Mm-hmm. And as good as John Damascene was, he was a very, very sinful human being. I mean, compared, like, has anyone made that connection before? Have you made that in a debate?
I don't know that I have. I did contrast, or at least point out, the amazing level of information that Al-Kindi includes in his dialogue. I mean, he has access to proto-Hadith sources. He tells many of the same stories that Bukhari does, but with fascinating extra information. He even has a listing of where the Mus'haf of Uthman were actually sent to, which cities they were sent to, where they went from there, when they were lost. It's amazing the information that Al-Kindi has. And I quoted Al-Kindi in my debate against Adnan Rashid on the preservation of the Quran in London last year. And
is that debate available?
Well, not yet, because and the funny thing was Adnan kept emphasizing that he doesn't have it yet either. It's a similar situation to a situation we've had where a third party, maybe on our side, does the videotaping, and then it takes us forever to get hold of the videotapes. That has happened to us. That's what's happening to him, and I'm dependent upon getting them from him for that one. And so the only way that has been available, it was briefly available because it was live streamed, but I don't think that's available anymore. But I'm pretty certain we should have it fairly soon. At least I hope so. But anyway, I think it's a perfectly fair observation and argument to make that the early Christians who specifically sought to respond to Islam did so on a significantly deeper, wider, fuller level than the Quran did. Now, obviously, the Muslim response is it doesn't matter because it's not the Quran's intention to go in depth, because then it would have to go in depth on all these different Christians. Well, I know, but they would say that because there were so many different Christian sects at the time, that it had to remain very general. That's sort of one of the arguments that has been presented to me, is that, well, you know, do you want it to recognize the difference between an Nestorian view of Christ or a Byzantine view of Christ and all the rest of that stuff? To which I say, well, okay. But it's still addressed to the people of the gospel. It's still addressed to the people of the book. And you can identify who they were in Muhammad's area. And even at that point, it's still not even close to being accurate in what it says concerning the subject of what Christians believe about God and so on and so forth. So I think it's a fair observation to make. And if you're talking to a Muslim who's actually going to give thought to what you're saying, there are many Muslims who will not. But if it's someone who's going to give thought to what you're saying, yeah, that would be a fair observation to make.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because like I'm just wondering if that's a good path to go down.
I think so. I think it's fair. And I would highly recommend to you if you get a chance to. The name of the book. It's not cheap, but I cite it numerous times in my book. So if you've ordered my book, and of course I'm sure you already have, if you pick up my book, you'll see I've got a number of Al-Kindi citations in the endnotes, and that'll give you the reference to the book I'm referring to here. You can get it off of Amazon. It's like I said, it's not cheap, but it's well worth it because it has all these early interactions that between Christians and Muslims all in one spot, and it's extremely useful.
Well, thank you, Doctor. If you don't mind, can I briefly add something else?
Sure, go ahead.
Have you heard of, I don't know if you've been keeping track of this, but have you heard of what Matthew Vines is doing?
Beyond what he was doing before, going around and...
He got commissioned to write a book by Random House.
Oh.
And he's promoting this gay Christian organization called, and you're going to hate this, you're going to hate this more than evangelical Catholicism, the Reformation Project.
Okay. So the Reformation of the Church to get rid of God's law, basically.
Yeah, it's antinomianism.
Yeah, definitely. No, first of all, I'm not at all surprised that Random House or other major publishers would give forth money to produce more books than they already are promoting homosexuality. But the Reformation Project, well, that's interesting. I am looking forward to my encounter with Justin Lee in May, who is one of the staff folks at what's the name of it? Gay Christian Alliance? Is that what it's called?
I'm not sure. I just picked up his book, though. So
I think you'll find it to be one of the better books in the sense that, I think it was imbalanced and it's just one huge, long polemic against any type of reparative therapy concept. I mean, that's really its primary focus. But beyond that, I think it's quite challenging, and I think it needs to be dealt with. And I'm looking forward to the dialogue with Justin. I hope it will be focused upon the real issues and be helpful to folks.
Yeah.
And if I'm doing it with Justin Lee, then maybe once I do it with Justin Lee, maybe Matthew Vines would be willing to, because he takes a very different perspective than Justin Lee does. That's just it. Once you've started reading this stuff, you finally start realizing there's only a certain number of positions you can take on each of these texts. And it's interesting that people sort of pick and choose, and Justin Lee's views are very different than Matthew Vines Matthew Vines?
Yeah,
was on the same text. So they end up contradicting each other, and yet they're all pretty much promoting the same thing. So maybe once we do the one, we'll get a chance to do the other. I don't know. We'll find out.
Okay.
All right.
I'm probably going to get arrested now up here for...
Yeah, probably. Yeah, you better be careful.
Mounties haul me down to room 101.
And yes, your name was Tom from Vancouver.
Tom from Vancouver. Yeah, that.
Tom from Vancouver. We'll put him off the scent that way. All right, man. Thanks.
All right. Bye, Dr. White.
God bless. Bye-bye. Yes, that was Tom from Vancouver. I misread it last time. looks like we're getting lots of calls today, even though we're at a different time than we normally are. Which is interesting. Normally when I change the time, then we just, that's the end of phone calls because, people are picking things up from iTunes and stuff like that. And it just doesn't work. Okay. Let's press on and talk to, Justin. Hi, Justin.
Hey,
how you doing?
Doing well.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. I was wondering about the doctrine of inerrancy.
Mm-hmm.
With regard to it on the original autograph, I was wondering how does that apply to the Old Testament? Because we hear so much from liberals that it has been edited so much. How would you address that?
You're gonna have to hit that right there. I'm having Rich do something in the office here, and is your question about the difference between the Old Testament and New Testament, or just the idea that we don't have autographs?
No, it's more about considering the Old Testament. Liberal scholars, for the most part, and I don't know too many. Conservative scholars on that. I know you've said that we've kind of let the Old
we
Testament
have.
Let it go. And so I was just wondering, do you generally affirm just a very small, very not widespread view concerning how the Old Testament was put together and how it's been used or
I'm not sure what you mean by what you're asking. When you say how it's been put together and how it's been used is different than a doctrine of inerrancy. Doctrine of inerrancy is a doctrine that specifically refers to the inspiration of Scripture, to the original writings of Scripture. It is not a doctrine that talks about the methodology of preservation of Scripture, because obviously the Old Testament, very, very different than the New Testament, much, much older, written over about 15 times as long a period of time, written by, about three times, who knows how many more, a number of Old Testament books, I have no earthly idea who wrote them. There's no indication of authorship or anything like that. Clearly some books are written over a period of time with multiple authors, for that matter. So you have a completely different situation than you have in the New Testament, which is written by a much smaller number of authors over a much shorter period of time, which is much newer in comparison to the Old Testament as far as the amount of time it has to go through transcription. And it's written in a completely different language, Hebrew, with a few chapters in Aramaic, but Hebrew was not meant to be a language that would be used to transmit documents all across the known world or something like that, unlike the Greek and the New Testament. And the methodology of the preservation of the Old Testament is its textual history, very different than the New Testament. The Old Testament documents are given specifically to the people of God. Even the New Testament says the oracles of God were entrusted to the people of God. They're entrusted to the Jewish people. And so they were in a minority language given to a specific people over against the New Testament documents, which were written by multiple authors in multiple times, multiple places, and is transmitted during the time of the Roman Empire, where you have persecution going on here, there, and everywhere. Very, very different. Just vast differences between the two. But that's not really necessarily relevant to the doctrine of inerrancy, which isn't talking about almost any of that.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, inerrancy is talking about the nature of, I hate to use this terminology, but the act of inspiration. Inspiration is not a term that is actually a biblical term. The biblical phrase that Paul uses is theanoustos, which means God breathed. Inspiration is a Latin term to breathe into something, and that's really not what we believe about it, but it's sort of taken on a life of its own. So it's the act of revelation itself, and inerrancy is basically addressing the question, how can an infinite God utilize finite, sinful human creatures and still communicate his word to us, yet in a language we can understand, and without destroying the personalities, vocabularies, and context of the original authors themselves? And so it has to do with, for example, all of the biblical writers live in a pre-critical period. They don't follow modern cosmologies. Right. And does that mean that God could not have communicated to us until, post-Hawking? For some people, that's almost what they believe. God could not have communicated himself until he sent Stephen Hawking to help us to understand. That kind of a thing. And so what's the relationship between what an author's understanding of science or philosophy of history or whatever else it might be, how does that relate to what they wrote as the Word of God? That's what inerrancy is referring to. And a lot of people confuse that with a claim that somehow we have photocopies of the autographs, and right. We don't have photocopies of the autographs, and we don't claim to have photocopies of the autographs. The fact is that God has used a different methodology to communicate his word to us. He could have done it that way, but he also could have left us wandering around in the darkness for a lot longer than he did, just so he wouldn't have to deal with these constant objections. But I can guarantee you, even if he had done that, we would have come up with a whole new set of objections at that point in time. There's no question about that. So, does that help at all?
Yeah, and also, I think kind of to maybe put the question a little bit differently. I know you've talked about when there are textual variants in the New Testament text,
mm-hmm.
That we shouldn't base put our theological position on the just that little
Right.
So I think that's kind of where the question was formed in me a little bit, kind of where I was getting on that. But, yeah, I think you've pretty well addressed that, unless you have anything to add there.
Well, I guess what you're referring to there is if you have a textual variant that is very difficult to come to a conclusion on, where the evidence is very evenly distributed, and it's just one of the real difficult ones, and there aren't that many of them, but there are a few, that you don't want to place an inordinate amount of emphasis upon one particular reading at that point. You might want to look to other texts where you don't have the same situation prevailing there. I can think of a number of possible ones, but there are textual variants where you have a much later reading. John 7:53 through 8:11, one of the two largest variants in the New Testament, the pericope adulterae. When I was at Trinity College Dublin, I specifically, you know, tried to lay to rest my Muslim friends who were constantly thinking, we don't know about these things, or we're not honest about these things. I said, look, the earliest manuscript we have this in is from 500 years after Christ, and it's a manuscript that is simply not reliable. And it goes from there. This is not a part of the original Gospel of John, and if I were preaching through the Gospel of John, I would stop at 752, probably do an entire sermon about issues like this to make sure everyone is fully understands what's going on there, and then pick up, in chapter 8 around verse 12. So that's what I would do. And if someone wanted to somehow base an entire theological position on that, or one that's – here's one that's even more, I think, understandable to folks that I think might be useful to folks, is I hear a lot of folks place a huge amount of theological weight on just off the top of my head, I think it's Luke 23:34. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And I just don't think that's wise at all, because there's it's a major textual variant in the sense that there's a wide variety of witnesses that do not contain that. And but I've heard people just build entire skyscrapers of theology on top of that one verse and never even mention. In fact, I'll be honest with you, I didn't know about that textual variant until, I don't remember the first time I found out about it, but I was well out of seminary before I even heard about it. I don't think I'd ever heard anybody talk about it before then. So nothing unusual there. But hopefully that's helpful to you, Justin. Thanks for your phone call today.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you. It was from that conversation on that very text that I found was thinking about that. And I put a note in your book, Potter's Freedom.
Oh, you put a note in my book?
Well, you know, where you address...
Oh, okay. I was going to say, how did you get into my office? Thanks, Justin. Yeah. Have a good day. Yep.
Thank you.
All righty. I really was worried about that. I'm starting to look under the table here, look behind me. You know, oh, there he is. He's on a cell phone in the corner of the studio here. That's a little scary. it's what happens after a metric century. Let's talk with Charles. Hi, Charles.
How you doing, sir?
I'm not telling where people are these days because I don't want you to get fired or, the thought police are going to start, especially up in Canada, but you're not in Canada, but I won't say anything more about that than that. So, anyway.
That's okay. I had a question. I went back and forth with some of my friends about this. In Exodus 24 through 5 and Deuteronomy 5, 8 through 9, when it talks about graven images and heaven or earth. Now, that in that context, is that the day as far as like movies that depict Christ?
Well, in the initial context, graven images are images which are specifically intended to portray deity so as to become objects of worship. There are now the real issue that people have disagreements about, and I'll give you both sides of the issue, is there are those that would say that you should not have an image of Christ because of the deity of Christ, and therefore to have an image of Christ. Well, first of all, we don't know what he looked like. And yeah. I will admit that most pictures I've seen of Jesus just give me the hives. The one with the, you know, the breck hair and the little lamb, you know, and all the rest of that stuff, just, you know. But at the same time, I have to wonder if the ministry of Christ took place today, would it be a violation of God's law to take a picture of Jesus? He was the God-man. He entered into human flesh. And I personally struggle with the idea that if there had been a painter sitting along the side of the road on the way to Jericho, if he had started painting a picture of Jesus as he walked by, you know, a caricature like Angels does for our website or something like that, that Jesus would have, you know, turned and struck him dead or sent the, you know, called fire down out of heaven or something like that.
Yeah.
I don't see that. So I think there needs to be respect, but I think that we need to recognize that, Jesus, when he walked down the roadways in Jerusalem, did not glow at night. He did not have a halo going on. There is only one time when his divine nature was truly seen in the sense of his pre-incarnate glory on the Mount of Transfiguration. And so other than that, I think if Da Vinci found some, you know, ancient photograph of the Last Supper or something like that, I have a hard time thinking that that somehow is a violation, unless the intention is to provide a mechanism for worship of something other than God himself. That leads into all sorts of questions about, well, but, you know, when you talk about worshiping Jesus, you know, what are you worshiping? Can we divide Jesus up into parts and say you're only worshiping a part of Jesus and like that? No, you can't, because he's the God man. So those are where the arguments lie. And I think it's good that we consider it. We think about it. I think it's far better to think about something and come to a conclusion than how most Christians do it. And that is, we take our traditions, we take what we're taught, and we assume that that's exactly what the Word of God is. And if someone comes up with another perspective, well, they just must be a terrible, horrible person, and they must be going to hell or whatever else it is. That's an unfortunate perspective that some people glom onto as well.
Okay. I had another question, but I don't
know. Sure, go ahead. There's no baby. There's nobody behind you, and everybody else is asked too. So it would be an imbalanced program if you only asked one question, because all the other callers had two questions. Didn't Rich tell you that? It's two question day. It's two question day. So even if you don't have another one, you've got to come up with one.
Okay.
Going to mock you for the rest of the hour.
Okay. This was a difficult one that I found out asking between different Christians. This has nothing to do with the graven image. This has to do with 1 Corinthians chapter 11. Regarding head covering. We went back and forth between me and my friend about this, like, all the time.
Talk about it. I almost said, unless you're going to ask about some really wild thing like head coverings and angels and or women saved in childbirth, at that point you can skip all that. And great. So you and your friends sit around talking about this stuff like this? You people are weird. I just thought I'd let you.
We just question. I guess the hot button topics are, people don't.
That's a hot button topic, really? Okay,
yeah.
Things are pretty pretty hopping down there in North Carolina. That's all I can say. Wow. Well, I'll tell you, I don't have a clue. Obviously, there are, again, some of my Reformed brethren would say, well, this is something that needs to be done. It's because it talks about the angels. It's not specifically limited to a cultural thing, et cetera, et cetera. Others would point out that in Corinth, the reason that a woman might wear a head covering was because the temple prostitutes in Corinth had their heads shaved. And so if a woman was a new convert and she was coming into the Christian assembly and she had her head shaved, then people would start wondering what was going on in the Christian assembly, and therefore it did have an immediate application type thing, et cetera, et cetera. So you'll find argumentation on both sides at that point. In our fellowship, we certainly do not demand head coverings, but likewise we wouldn't in any way say that a woman could not wear head coverings if she felt that was appropriate for her to do. Amongst Reformed Baptists, you'll find both perspectives expressed at that point. Personally, I would have a hard time defending the idea of it being a sort of command for all time in light of the context in 1 Corinthians. But if there are those that take that viewpoint, I'm not gonna spend too much time unless we're just sitting over dinner and we've got nothing better to do, sort of like you guys do. There are those times that happen.
Yeah, but that's not nice. Okay. Okay. Well, thank you very much for taking my call and asking my question.
Okay. Thanks for calling in.
All right.
Bye. Bye. I made him laugh. That's so if you can't do anything else, you make somebody laugh, and that's a good thing. So. we get good calls here on the. I'm really surprised. It's an off time show, because it's normally on. Well, actually, right now for everybody, even if we did it at 11 o'clock this morning, it would have been an off time show, because the rest of you are still suffering from time lag because you played with your clocks, and we didn't play with our clocks. But because you people play with your clocks, I have to play with my clocks. Because I have atomic clocks. And some of them don't have the thing where you can turn the daylight savings time off thing off. There you go. And so I still have to play with my clocks, even though I live in the only state left in the union where we recognize. Oh, I know they stopped. Yeah, we're it. We are alone. We are alone in standing against this tide. And do you remember when we tried it? Remember 74, 75, something like that? It was the mid-70s. I remember that because we were here and we moved here in 74.
Well, we're standing against this nation on a lot of levels. So
yeah, that's true. That's
kind
true.
Of, we might as well just be Arizona and stand our ground. And
except
that.
In Phoenix where we have transgendered bathrooms. But
well,
trying to be like San Francisco or something. Yeah. Anyway, we did try it 1 year and we voted it down the next year because it would be like 10 o'clock at night, still light outside and 110 degrees. Nah, doesn't work too well. Doesn't work too well. Anyways, Lord willing, I just realized, no program on Thursday at all because I am in Southern California on Thursday. Just a quick trip over, but you're probably going to have to pick me up on Friday. No, I'll probably just take my car since one day. But let's try to sneak one in on Friday if at all possible. We'll try to sneak a program in. We'll let you know on the blog, Twitter, Facebook, all that kind of stuff. So we'll see you Thursday at some point in time, but it'll always be Mountain Standard Time that we'll see you. See you then. God bless.
I believe we're standing at the crossroads. Let this moment us flow away. Contend for the faith the fathers fought for. We need a new Reformation Day. It's a sign of the times. The truth is being trampled in a new age paradigm. Won't you lift up your voice? Are you tired of playing religion? It's time to make some noise.
The Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-4602 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracts. Join us again this Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m. for The Dividing Line.